Secondly, my course is on special leave, but we don't know her. I spoke to her over the weekend. And Tavi, please, can we just sit down? We can't hear all this thing. Secondly, my course is on sick leave, I know, but she said she'll try to come. I don't know where she's at. Dez is caught up in the N1 traffic. Apparently, there's a whole lot of refurbishment taking place on the road, or I don't know, construction. Now, we've informed that this time round, given the failure of the negotiations between the Nihau workers and the management, that they are determined to stop all meetings today. They're entering a new phase now, much more aggressive phase. So it's likely, we were told it happened on Friday, it's likely they're going to come here at some stage. I spoke to one of them. Nobody is contacting me officially for Nihau, but obviously MPs, I think, are being lobbied. They preserve us are too silent. And we explain what some MPs are doing. There's also a structure of MPs, former trade unionists mainly, who are assisting in an advisory capacity, I think. So they rang me for different reasons. I didn't do a lot of committee meetings. But one of them rang me this morning to say that they are definitely going to stop all meetings today. And we'll see. The arrangement that's been made is that we will go to the National Treasury, is that right? What floor is that?
Third floor.
120 Plain Street. The DG's boardroom. The DG's boardroom. Right, so that's where we're going. The aim today, I hope Roy is here, I just speak to him, is to deal with the tax bills and then move on to looking at the Twin Peaks bill. Now, we've been exempted from the sittings of the House, but we are required to go and vote. So, when we reconvene this afternoon at 2, we will meet in G26. In the meanwhile, can I check, is Roy going to be here this morning? Because we said that as soon as we...
I have told the team to come. Okay, so I would say that some of the...
But you can take us through the...
Yeah. I could start in...
It's not a little early time. Okay. All right, thank you very much. So, we're going to start with your response to the issues raised, is that right, Momo?
Yes.
Then we're going to look at other issues. I think one of the things is that there have been some negotiations taking place to get some agreement with the trade union that are disaffected. And we need a bit more time for that. So what might happen, depending on the way the meeting pans out, is we might deal with the tax with the uncontested parts, then adjourn for, I think the majority part would like a study group meeting, and then we can come back an hour or so later and continue the process. We also need to consult with the DG's office and so on, because we are answerable to it, like all parties are to the DG's office. We will see how things pan out. Okay, shall we move on?
Okay, we were asked to present a few things to the committee. And just as you know, what we always do is we have a response document. We've just done a draft second response document, which just deals with all the comments that were received by the committee and a handful of comments even by the Treasury directly. So we've got that document. We also have, for purposes of an amendment to the money bill, we have to provide our response to certain criteria in terms of Section 11.5 and A5. So we've also prepared just a note for that. Chair, we do have, and we're ready to talk about the communication strategy, which we were asked for as well. And I think that we made the point that we agree that retirement is too important to people's lives. and take things for granted and not communicate fully and properly with members, even though some of this should be done in the first instance by trustees or the board in informing their members. But certainly we would want to help them in informing members. Chair, I should just add that, and you know, with the response document, we normally, once the committee has finalized the position, we then take the response document and we update it so that it reflects the actual change in the final bill. So that's why there's still drafts. Now, the other reason we have a need to be guided by the committee is I think you would have seen pretty strong statements emerging, I think, on retirement reform from COSATU on the one hand, and I notice from the chair there's a number of letters coming through to the committee. I think that we need clarity within the business constituency who's speaking for whom. There's been some not very polite letters coming to certainly myself in the Treasury, to the point where one person accuses me of misleading the committee. I just want to bring that to your attention because certainly I'll never mislead this committee, and I will take on anyone who makes that accusation, and we'll present the facts as we see it, and as I think as we've presented. So I think we'll just go through first, I think, all the key points that have been raised. I think they do cover even some of the new comments, because some of them are on the content, some of them are on the process to get to the these amendments. So I'll be guided by you. And in fact, as we remind everyone, the bill is now in the hands of Parliament and certainly not the Treasury. And it's for you to be the wise Solomons then to make a final decision as a committee. So I think just to go through this, and certainly we have other supporting material that we could provide, but I think we've had to, it's not helped that whilst we welcomed the rains in Gauteng yesterday, it caused chaos.
Chaos.
And but let's not complain. The rain was very good for the country and for Gauteng, certainly where it comes from. So Chair, just to go through then, I think maybe let's just walk through the key points that we've raised. Just you want to, or Alana, do you want to just start and I'll sort of come in? Okay, you don't have this as well. Do you have another copy of our document?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, honourable members. The document really just goes through the process, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, and then it also goes through the details of the legislation in terms of the timeline of what happened. We made the legislative changes in 2013, we made some smaller amendments in 2014, and then what happened this year. And then this year, we published a draft TLAB on the 22nd of July. This is the top of page 2. Which basically kept the amendments as they were, the 2013 amendment as amended again by 2014. After some consultations and some lack of agreement on the impact of Provident Fund members, we then put a revised bill that was tabled in Parliament, as you all know, with a different policy proposal that had a phased-in approach for a new annuitization for Provident Fund members. That's at the top of page 2. So the process on then was we released a media statement with our TLAB, we consulted on various options with industry on those options. In the media statement we said that the table TLAB was just one of the potential options. We had those consultations, we've got a list of respondents at the back of this, there were about 25 written submissions. We also met with industry and discussed their concerns on the different options in the very short consultation period. We then came back to the committee.
Can I just add, not just industry, we met with the union federations, and certainly anyone who was interested. So when you talk about the industry, you shouldn't also just see them as one body. It's had, for example, people who represent employers, just with their logistics. it's the payroll companies. There's a few companies that do the payrolls for most companies, and certainly there's the industry itself, the people who actually administer the funds, and the administrators and so on. So there were distinct groupings that we spoke to, and often the discussion was also just on, aside from the content, on the logistics, because it doesn't help to put any proposal if it's impossible to implement. And I should add, and we'll give you all the dates of the NADLAG meeting, so nobody can be in any doubt. Lots of consultations within NADLAG. People can, I think we've always said we couldn't reach agreement within NADLAG, and therefore the process didn't really go anywhere. And on one hand, we just, most of the decisions were from certainly one or two players, we can't proceed until there's a social security reform paper. To the point that we think, even if it went next year to NADLAG, I don't believe that there's going to be a different outcome from what we have, even if the paper was released. Because I think that, and you heard the argument, so we'll actually specify all the dates that we try to have meetings, because when you have meetings, it depends on all parties whether they agree to a date. And if people don't agree to a date, well, they can't be a NADLAG meeting. So that's not too uncommon.
So those meetings are actually contained in Anexure E of the same document on page 7, which is all the meetings we held at NADLAG.
Well, we want to collect all the dates.
Yeah, but that's at least the meetings. I mean, well, you wanted two more, but we just want to confirm the dates. But we thought those that we could confirm, we certainly bring to your attention today.
Can I just ask a question?
Were all the unions involved in the recent negotiations?
Chair, at NADLAG, certainly three federations attend. That's COSATU, MACTU, and FEDUSA. Okay. There are other unions at the outside, obviously NUMSA, so they're no longer part of, they don't have direct membership with NADLAG, or if they take solidarity, I think because they're not a union federation, or I don't know what the rules are in the labor constituency, but so when you go, certainly the federations would be there. But because things were not working, we also met with players individually, okay? And we've generally encouraged everyone, be they in business, labor, to provide an input to the committee or at least say where they stand, certainly on the options that we were consulting on. So hence, I think you got the responses from some of them. And in fact, what we need to coordinate here is some of them have written to the Treasury, and I'm not sure if we have made those, so we want to do it just a full set of the comments that we received. It's a slightly different consultation process because it was around the media release on the table though, which then was different from the consultation that you had. This will just point out where they are. But do you want to just go through it, Chris?
Look, can I ask for guidance from members, right? What do we want? Firstly, you can present all the empirical evidence that you had these meetings, right? There are people who contest that these meetings took place. Sometimes they contest the nature of the meeting. They would say the meetings were not for actually engagement and give and take and negotiations. They were more for information. Now, at this stage, I don't know, given all the constraints we're facing, firstly, I got a lot of the emails this morning from 6:10 to about, I think, 7:49. And I must tell you, my yesterday was a horrendous day for a variety of reasons. I don't know, Paul, you was caught up in a scam. Don't be hardworking if it's not worth it. Somebody contacts me and says she's in Cyprus, somebody I didn't know, and her passport's gone, and the visa's gone, everything's gone, the money. And then I contacted the Deputy Minister of Home Affairs, the DG of Home Affairs, the Parliamentary Liaison Officer of Home Affairs, a senior official of Home Affairs, only to discover that somebody had hacked into an email, and because I had applied to it, made me very vulnerable. So I have decided it's not good to be a hard-working MP. I don't think any other MP would, within 10 minutes, contact the whole world to rescue this person. Right, so then that led to a series of things. I contacted the banks and found what's going to happen to my credit card and so on and so on. And then, of course, I got this Basata statement, and then there were a whole lot of issues in my constituency office and provincial politics. So my day, I had an 18-hour day yesterday, and it was substantially unproductive. 18 hours later, I got nothing for my labor power. No labor value there. Right? So, so what I'm suggesting is, I'm putting it to amendment. You see, I feel that I have not been able to, because we don't have the services. I think members of this committee should have all the emails that were sent me this morning. I will send it to you after this meeting. In the absence of those things, those things that are sent to me, which are not sent to me personally, sometimes the chairperson, Frank, has a discretion about whether you give. We've discussed this before, every letter to everybody. Because we are slandering things about people and so on. So I will say that to them. Secondly, I would like to ask members, is there anybody who feels that the National Treasury has deliberately misled this committee? If that's the case, then I think Momo, you and your team must answer.
Yes.
But if it's a situation that you're saying, you had these meetings, and the difference of interpretation between you and some of the stakeholders about the nature and quality of the meeting, that is something I don't think at this stage, in this particular set of circumstances, in this context, we want to explore. But in other situations, we have done it before, between the South African local government, so just to show you precedence in this parliament, SELGA and the department, between 1999 and 2004, we actually carried out an inquiry about the nature of the consultation between SELGA and the department. And I set up a subcommittee, the opposition party were interested, and proceeded and reported back. That's different because of the nature. Here, given all the circumstances, we need to vote on these bills. There's a strike out here. We have limited administrative resources. You must have the right, Momonia, particularly. If your integrity is attacked in the public domain, and this is parliament, you should have a right to respond. And then it's the right of the members to decide on your integrity. So if you feel your personal integrity is under severe assault, I can't stop you. But on the other hand, I'm not sure that members here feel, well, let me ask, that you like you deliberately and intentionally misled the committee, which if you do, Frank Jenkins, I'm not sure in Parliament you can't do that. You'll be regarded as committing an offence. But in a committee, presumably, there's similar normatic, it is a normative notion, right? So then you have a right, you must have a right to reply. But those people are not here to reply either. So all I want to suggest, can members tell me if they think Ismail Momonya in particular and the National Treasury as a whole has deliberately misled this committee? Tandy?
Chair, I'm going to start on an accent. When I was growing up in politics, I was told that when you explain gender, you are told that men are masculine and women are feminine. Now, I wonder whether this intervention not needs some women to cool the egos and the tempers of that are flaming between the labor movement and National Treasury. You know, I think if you can have women in those meetings, men will indulge in how the energy looks and then make them forget the intellectual battle that they fight. Secondly, the other one is that it's interesting to listen to an actual, which is Momo, wanting to justify in numbers how many meetings he has had with people, and listening to you, a sociologist, who believe in engagement, thorough engagement, whether you reach a compromise or something, but that's what you do. So it actually is very us.
You studied mathematics.
You see, and the other people are not interested in mathematics. You see, they are interested in something else. So for the first time, I'll see how this one will sort itself out. Now to the issues. Yeah, I don't believe National Treasury has deliberately. Because in Parliament, when we say deliberately, is when we say that you knew that you were misleading us, so deliberately you gave us wrong information. So I do not believe they have answered. I believe there are misunderstandings between certain segments that are interested parties to the position and the presentation of such material. I also hold a view that there will come a point where we want to reach a compromise. It's not going to be about the number of meetings that has been had. It's going to be how we influence each other to understand one another and to take each other's views on board. It's going to be a very fascinating process for you who have done this other work, but I hope you will bear with the environment that we are finding ourselves in. You will remember when I made you, because I tried to bring this element in, that we are in a society that has particular challenges, and based on that, you will now and then have such reflections. Difficult as they may be, we will have to find one another. So, Chair, where we agree, we will continue. Where we disagree, we will postpone to have further reflections. That's my humble submission.
So I think basically don't spend too much time on the number of meetings you've held, but you're right on reply. I also want to, when I send these emails, I also want people to really Google some of these people and look at what in particular vested interests are. I think we can agree to disagree robustly without questioning people's integrity. It's not about personal integrity. As Pani says, in a way, it's like where you are, at vantage point you occupy, the interests you represent, political, material, or both. And how you see things from a particular vantage point. You will say you had these meetings and you engaged and you negotiated, they will say, oh, they just informed us and they did it nominally to the tick box thing. So I don't think we want to pursue that right now. The more important thing is that we have to find each other somehow between now and the time we vote. Okay, having said that, so can we move to the substance of the issues rather than the number of meetings? But Mom, if you wanted anything about your personal integrity, you are right to do so.
Yeah. No, Chair, I think the point is, and I think it's certainly, not just to speak for myself, certainly for JJ, I think for us, it's a strong principle that we don't mislead Parliament. I think Parliament is really a very important institution. And I say to people, in fact, we want to commit to this robust debate and no rubber stamp. If you rubber stamp what we did, you wouldn't be doing your job. And in fact, you could check on us. And I think that's an important role, because even we, like everyone, you come with a certain perspective. And I think that to get other perspectives is quite important. Just on the text side...
To avoid... Because there are people who have written to you.
Yes.
And they've written to me. I will send the emails out to people, right? And then they will come back with their responses, maybe tomorrow. So, to Sandy, can you remind me, the first thing I do is send the emails to them, because they write to see them.
Yes.
So why don't we do for now, unless there's evidence to the contrary that emerges, there's a perhaps understandable misunderstanding about the nature of the negotiations. But that there have been negotiations since 2012, I don't think this committee contests my practical nature. And I think the Tani says is reflecting the views of this committee. We're not suggesting that there are deliberate distortions. It's understandable given the nature of the issues we're looking at. Okay, so
just one line. Sure. You see, there is a particular protocol now on how things to get in process in Adelaide, but I think what we're saying is things have broken down to such an extent that you can't even go through that process. And in fact, even on the next year, ESC, that it's
been... Yeah, to the National Treasury, you've been saying that you've used terms like there's been no agreement. It gets nowhere. So you never said that there's any consensus. I think that's correct. None of us have understood you to mean that there is consensus. Fine. Okay, can we move on to the substance of the issues, please?
And Chair, not just on that, I think that the other point, though, is that with tax proposals, as you know, I think it's important to look at the role of lobbying. And I think it's fine. Yeah, some people come to represent organizations, some people come in their personal capacity, and then you have to judge. And with tax proposals, you never know the impact until people have commented. The difficulty comes, though, if somebody says, I represent organization X, and then you start getting a plethora of emails in the person's name, and the other people are not even GC'd. Then you get confused. Is this person representing himself? Is he representing the organization? And that's why I think what I say to people, look, if it's yourself and you're different, that's fine. Come and put it forward, send Parliament an input. But I think what doesn't help is when people try and say, you know, they're part of this and this is the organizational position when it's actually not. And I think that's some of the issues that count. And I think the way the Treasury handles input is we don't, whilst we talk to people, we also, with tax, it's quite important if you don't give, just because you raise an issue, is if you info which then others don't have. So that's why if people send us letters to say, what's your position on 1, 2, 3, we like to say, our position will be in the response doc, where we respond to all the issues that have been raised, but we don't say X or Y has raised this. And so when we go through the content, that's where we will go through all the substantive points. But it's really, I don't think it's a good idea to respond to every submission individually, because that gets us into very strong discussions then, because people fight to the death for why. But you also don't want to give anyone special information that others don't have, especially in tax policy. So I think, Chair, then to just get to the issues, let's just go through. So what we've done is once you get to the formal submissions, we've got 12 submissions to the parliamentary process. That's up to yesterday. But like you say, Chair, there's been lots of submissions raining since, so we will have to update the number. But up to yesterday, those we saw, 11 of the 12 were on the retirement reform, and one was on the insurance side, and that's not contested, but we've dealt with that matter as well. I think we've resolved that issue. Over and above that, yes, there's been correspondence to the Treasury, which we also have listed, and certainly will provide. It's in the next at the back. So let's look at the comments. I think the first issue, Chris, why don't you talk through this, the definition of pension funds or Olano 2.1.
The first issue was just...
Are you on page 3?
This is on page 3, 2.1, this comment. So this is really on the proposal by the SCOF of do we go ahead with these changes to the Tickle Bill. This comment was general from, I think we put it above, that 8 of the 11 submissions favored the proposal, and this is their reason for why they favored the proposal of changing the table bill to align with what the previous legislation said. They thought that doing that would achieve the main objectives of simplification, harmonization, and encouraging preservation. The current design would encourage consolidation of retirement funds, which would then bring down costs and in effect help members. If we were to do this very large change at the last minute, they felt that there were large IT costs involved. A lot of those would be sunk costs because they've now changed all their systems. If we now do a new policy proposal, they'll have to rearrange their systems again. And any delays, any further delays, so they did believe that it was good to go ahead with what the old legislation said from 1 March 2016. Because any further delays would further increase any uncertainty in the industry and among the public, and it would diminish confidence in the retirement fund industry from members. They thought it was a good proposal and that it should go forward. Our response, this is really what our proposal was to the SCOF, so we would obviously agree with that. And it really does stem from all the previous submissions we received on our small consultation. So we did agree that it would, you know, we believed it would achieve the objectives. And also we thought that it was important to try and stop what we think is avoidance of tax through using these schemes where higher income individuals can get very large deductions without being required to purchase an annuity. These new mechanisms will bring in a monetary cap which will make the system more progressive and more equitable in our view. Do you want to talk about the second one?
Thanks, Chris. Chair, so the second one is around the comprehensive social security paper. So as we briefed the committee the last time, that it is true that the paper has taken quite a while to work on. We remain committed to finalizing the paper. It has been challenging because there are other departments involved, social development and labor. But by and large, Chair, we have managed to reach some agreement on some of the key issues, just minor issue that we need to refine. and hopefully the paper will go to the principals, to the ministers, and it will be hopefully released. So Chelsea indicated we prefer a gradual approach to retirement reform. So instead of waiting for everything to come together on day one, and you can see the challenge of that. So effectively, we've been waiting for more than 10 years for everything to come together on day one. So it does suggest that the best approach is to try and see where the critical areas are and try and deal with those, as long as you ensure that whatever you are doing incrementally will be in alignment with the ultimate vision or objective of a comprehensive social security, depending on how that ultimate end goal will look like. And as I said, Chair, we have benefit in the sense that we have been watching the social security papers, so we can fairly say that what we are doing with the retirement reforms is pretty much aligned with what is going to be contained in the comprehensive social security paper. So I think the message there is that we still want to address the critical areas, whether it's in the form of preservation and retiring, dealing with the current complex tax system for retirement reform, some of the challenges around the cost issues, including also governance issues, which Parliament actually helped us a great deal the last time when we brought the Financial Services Law General Amendment Act. So I think that's our response, Chair, if there are any additions.
And the next one was on, which we discussed in this committee previously, was on the mandatory cap, and that it doesn't encourage individuals to save further. Those people really face higher progressive taxes and a higher overall tax burden, and it hasn't been adjusted since 2012-13, it should be increased upwards. You know, we felt quite strongly that we needed to improve equity in this area and that there is a reason for having this mandatory cap. We also, as we discussed earlier, we thought there were generous provisions where the individual can still get that relief through rollovers and also by not being taxed when they receive that money. On the value of the cap, we just put some evidence here that initially it was at 200, then it went up to 300, then it went up to 350 in the 2013 Act, but only for implementation from 1 March 2015. So it's not as if the 350 hasn't been adjusted upwards since 2013. It was legislated as 350 to be 1 March 2015. So in effect, we're a year behind what the real value of the cap is. Saying that it is a threshold, and the Minister of Finance can review threshold and announce different thresholds in the budget, which he does each year, and that could be part of the considerations. The next one is on, we had some comments that in the media statement we released on the 16th of October 2024, we said that if there wasn't agreement in NEDVAC, then the implementation date would be moved to 1 March 2017. And they're saying, well, there hasn't been agreement in NEDVAC, so it should be delayed to 1 March 2017. Our comment to that is we didn't make an upfront commitment from the media statement. All we said was that we may consider moving the implementation date to 1 March 2017. So I don't think that binds us to actually then delaying that date. It was just that it was one of the options. Or until the Social Security paper is released, which Anna has spoken about. I mean, just note, the majority of respondents thought we should go ahead straight away and we should delay and have further uncertainty. The last comment is on the GEPF members. There was a submission received that said we have explicitly excluded GEPF members from this amendment, which then means that civil servants such as ourselves won't be applicable to the tax deductibility limit. And how could it be that civil servants can create legislation that gives them a favorable position? We'd like to say that isn't true. The GEPF members and all members will fall under the tax deductibility limits in the Income Tax Act. So they will form part of the 27.5% and they will form part of the 350. What we did explicitly exclude the GEPF from was the requirement to purchase an annuity in the definition of income funds right at the front. The GEPF is a defined benefit fund, and as a defined benefit fund, it pays out as an annuity. So you get a 6.7% times your final salary as a lump sum, and then the rest you get as a final salary scheme, which is an annuity. So because it's already an annuity, we didn't believe that there was a need to then enforce the neutralization requirements on them in any case. So there isn't any special treatment there. Part of the material you can
apply. And, you know, we could have certainly included it because it already complies. There's no issue there. The government has direct control and things won't change. But the reason why we didn't is a lot of the resignations from our analysis is in the GEPF, which we haven't changed the legislation before, and wants to say we're not changing it now because there's no problem there. It's in line. And if you even were to change an O and N or a comma, then people will, you know, it becomes the reason for why people should resign. The issue there we've contended very strongly is really indebtedness, and there's big issues there, and it's particular categories like teachers, nurses, other health workers who are keenly checking out. And part of it, and then I think that tells you, information is dangerous, okay? Is suddenly the GEPF at the end of 2013 started sending us benefit statements, and people saw how much cash they have, and it did say, you know, you get tax, don't do this, etc. You've got to provide the info with, gets to the communication point. So we just felt we shouldn't really touch GEPF now. It's not a problem. And by the way, it's unlike other entities that also have, so GEPF doesn't fall under the Pensions Fund Act, and unlike the other similar funds, like you get Transnet and so on, they don't fall under GEPF. We want them covered because that's where we don't have direct control as government to make sure that they comply with the tax legislation as we want it. So certainly we don't think that for us we want to neutralize is an option because we're public servants and we're better than everybody else. So I think it's easy just to deal with, Chair. So I think
yeah, I just wondered whether we don't agree on it. You see, a lot of what you're saying is repetitive, right?
Yes.
Pulling it together. In fact, I can't see anything new you're saying. That's why I haven't looked at each item. Why don't we let them finish and then we look at each item? Because
yes.
You've covered the ground so many
yes.
times, right? And I think really it's about where we go from.
Yes.
That's what you think. But Tandy, you can come in as soon as you can still about to finish anyway.
Yeah, no, we're almost done. So, okay, yes, you're right. This is repetition. We've all our slides have covered it. But just for the sake of the, you know, we do like to make sure that every comment received, that the points raised, that we responded to in writing to the committee.
Yeah.
So that's the process. And I think the last point just deals with the, to move away from retirement reform, was on the insurance issue. And that matter really was resolved. We just provide that. And remember, we reverted back now to the draft as in as able, right? Remember, there was an attempt to amend that, and one insurer complained. And when we met the last time, we agreed that that would be removed. So we'll revert back to what it was, and it will kick in 1st of January next year. So, Chair, I think that's it in terms of the response document. Next year, if you just turn the page, is firstly the people responded to the Treasury media statement, and all of these we will make available. It sort of got taken over then by the second process in SCOF, so that's how people responded to different issues. So, but I think one does get the thrust of it, and as I said, the next year is the list of the meetings. I know that there's at least one date that's missing is 21 or 27 July. And that's it, Chair, on our side there, is there any? Yeah.
Okay. Tani?
Yes. I'm changing any of my views that I raised earlier on. Something just came to mind when we're dealing with this part where it explains why Provident Fund members are the ones that are supposed to annuitize, and GEPF members are already in the system. I'm suspecting the gist of the matter lies between these two. I'm trying to think, you know, out of the box, I don't know, that there might, maybe there's a misunderstanding on this clause. Maybe people think that GPs members are being left out. I'm trying to paint the scenario. What if this is the case? Can't we re-explain it? Chair? I know I have got a different view altogether. I don't believe it's this. And I don't want to reiterate it here. But it brings the question you asked about other generations. You know? Because I still believe if people at grassroots level can be explained to, they will not hold a different view altogether about this. So, can we, just for the last round, try to explain this part?
Okay. Other comments? Okay.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Chris, for the reassurance on the tax cut-off threshold on GEPF. But how does that, how will it apply? What is the mechanism to it for it to apply if it's not, if it's excluded from the definition? I'm not sure that I'm explaining myself. So 27.5%, you say, will apply. Through which act will it apply? Okay, so because if the GEPF is excluded here, where does this, that's fine. And then the annuity, the lump sum that's paid out on retirement, if it exceeds the $347,500, there's no requirement for additional, there's no annuitization of that. I mean, exactly what the payout is, the lump sum payout on retirement, and whether or not it could exceed the day limits, to use the term the chair loves so much, and what the implications there are. Thank you.
Okay, anybody else? No? Okay, go for it.
Okay. Let me start and then Mr. Milano can come in. If you take current law, okay, there's two issues that we're dealing with, okay? Firstly, it's the issue of how do we tax contributions to retirement funds. That law was changed in 2013, and there was a bit of amendment in 2014, but that's the current law. So if the new DLAB is not passed, that will take effect from the 1st of March next year, that all your contributions now on a similar base of income will now be 27.1% of your total income as you define it, up to a maximum of 350,000 rand. So that will already happen if we weren't to pass the current bill, for example. With regard to the other aspect is annuitization, in terms of the Pensions Fund Act, if you are a pension fund, you have to, at the point of retirement, after 60 or 65, I don't know if the age is, could vary, but you can take 2/3 as an annuity and 1/3 as a lump sum. Okay, that applies to pension funds, it applies to retirement annuities. Okay, and for pension funds and retirement annuities, at the moment you do get a tax deduction even before the 27.5%, but it was not kept. Would have that 15% of non-pensionable income on annuities, and all your bases would differ, okay? So that's the way things are. If you're a provident fund currently, effectively, the employer contribution is tax deductible, not just for the employer, but for you, it's a non-taxable fringe benefit, so it's just like getting the tax deduction on the employer contribution. But if you make your own contribution over and above the employer contribution, you don't enjoy a tax deduction, that is from post-tax income. In return, therefore, you don't annuitize. Okay. Now, so what are we changing now? We're trying to give the same tax deduction to everybody, including for members of provident funds. But we're also saying that we also want everyone to annuitize. So the only people it should then affect is really provident funds, because it's already the case for pension funds and retirement annuity, okay? And that's why even GEPF would fall into the current pension funds. So you're not changing anything for them, even though you might try it generally. we did have a few loopholes that we identified last year, because if you read the actual Income Tax Act, Section 8, Acres, what is it? It's impossible to understand. And in fact, it's impossible to understand. But this is more impossible than the normal impossibility. Okay? And you found that there's all kinds of funny categories. So we had to realize that some were not covered, and we've closed that loophole. Okay, so that was a technical amendment because it was never intended. So that was done. When we dealt with that loophole, let me say there's still many loopholes currently because let me say to all, this is not a secret land to preserve. There's no preservation changes to preservation currently. But we are going to introduce preservation. Not 100%, but allow for some balance between what can you take out before. But the answer can't be that you can take out the whole amount at any time when you resign. So given this annuitization, even as we introduce a law, how do you get around it? Resign 1 month before you retire, and that's a loophole that we need to close. Okay, it's not been done here. It's not a tax issue. It will be sorted out hopefully next year. But we want to put a discussion document so that people understand what form of preservation do we want as a society. Okay, so those loopholes have not been sorted out. So we haven't changed preservation in these acts. But Chris, do you want to answer the specifics just on that? And can I just say, on GPF though, so therefore we don't have to change anything on the GPF, like we don't have to change generally for a pension fund on the annuitization side. But with GPF, it is the largest fund. It has had its own issues. I don't think it's really been an issue raised by the unions or anyone. It's come from one person within the business, or I think in the PUSA, original PUSA submission, there was a query on why is GPF been exempted, and it was put as if we are favoring GPF so that they're not covered by this when everybody else has been covered, and that's because they're covered already.
Yes, Honourable. The tax deduction is in section 11K of the Act, and then that'll just apply to all retirement funds, and then because the annuitization requirement is dealt with in the definitions of pension fund, etc., in section 1, we can then split the treatment. So that's how it would work in practice. So in the annuitization requirement, we've taken GPF out because they're already annuitized. But then in the tax deductions for contributions, all of the funds are included anyway, so it's dealt with separately. And then on lump sum, I mean, an example, with the annuitization threshold of 247,500, if you've got 247,000, you can take the full thing as a lump sum. If you've got 250,000, you can take 83,300 as a lump sum, and you'd be required to purchase an annuity with 166,600. And that's how it's good.
Alright, let's have Jim, just quickly, so in MoMA you explained that, in terms of retirement annuities and pension funds, there's a 1/3, 2/3 split. So if the 1/3 then exceeds the 247,500, they just take it? So unlike in the defined benefit fund I'm talking about. You don't have to take the 1/3. You can take up to 1/3 as a lump sum, and that lump sum might exceed the 247,500. That's all I'm saying. In the GPF, yeah. And what then? There's nothing to stop that. I mean, that's the law. You can take 1/3, and that's it.
So the way the GPF will work is that it operates in terms of its own rules. And I think that's a good point. So what they need to do then is to align in terms of understanding their own rules to how does it work,
Like complicated. So my understanding is it depends on your
employment period. So if you spend 10 years in government, you are entitled to a gratuity, which means a full lump sum. If you have, I'm trying to simplify, if you have worked more than 10 years, that's where you are entitled to a set cash lump sum and balance you get as an annuity. So it depends on the period of employment.
Let us check, because the point is that the GEPF generally will change its rules to align with, and it means if you're going to change the GEPF, you have to change the GEPF Act. So that's what we need to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for indulging me. My apologies for not reading properly.
That's okay.
Okay, Tandi, are you fine with what you asked?
Okay. Now if you can go my route, I'll take all the money and keep it and give people a monthly income. Don't even ask me my opinion.
Okay.
People are a problem to the system.
That's not to be coached into the journalist. Right, so basically, can I suggest that we had asked the committee side to give us their summary, right, on our side, Bridget and you, of, they gave us their reply, we'd like to give them Parliament's research support, as has been done, on the submissions that were in written form. People who do not appear before our committee, and they have a right to be heard, right, you have National Treasury. And for the cross purpose of last week. Welcome, Yana. We thought you weren't anyhow with strikes. We see you here. Alright, so did you do obviously, Bridget is not available, and Tumasani is overcome by all the work he has to do. So we might have to accept that National Treasury has covered it. We haven't raised any issues, but we've considered all the submissions. While I was on my keypad here, I was sending to somebody, because I don't have all the email addresses, you, the submissions received since late last night. So Momak sent that exchange between you and the individual concerned, because you wanted that. I have made a statement and a submission from other people this morning. So you will get it in the next 5 minutes or so by somebody else. Huh? So we want to look at that. So I think, unless we've got Parliament's response, what we could very quickly consider is it was considered by the subcommittee and accepted, and because Comrade Jayes is not here and we have to comply with sections 8.5 and 11.3, can you take us through this quickly?
Yeah, okay, so that... So
my understanding would be that this becomes relevant if we're going ahead with the amendments, right?
Yes.
And if we're not going ahead with amendments, or we think of something else, then obviously this will fall away, right? So the question I wanted to ask you is not to go through it in great detail, just give us a quick overview. Just table it as a question.
So, Chair, we went through this slide, and you are correct. So this relates to the Annexure A, all those proposed amendments to the table vote. I thought we were going to have those copies here today, but anyway, and it needs to deal with those. So there are five factors that we needed to look at, especially in section 11.3 or 11.5? 11.3, okay. So the first is, does it affect the revenue framework? And we say no, because if we make no change, largely it would be the same status as what was in operation at the time of the budget. And this requires us only to compare to the fiscal framework at the time of the budget, not in the MTBPS. Okay, that's a new factor. But it actually, on both, it's not significant. And we go into, I don't know if we're going to talk the detail, because we assume most people will take the entire sum in a lump sum if they're below 247. But we can deal with it. We deal with the issue of equity. Clearly, we are moving towards more equity that's been on vertical equity, and certainly more on horizontal equity. And in a sense, by having all these amendments, we are creating uncertainty. The sooner we make a decision, we will get more certainty either way. It doesn't affect the composition between direct and indirect taxes, because there's no significant impact on revenue. And In terms of regional and international trends, well, our neighboring countries and in our region, generally pension funds are not very developed. So it's hard to say what trends there are. In fact, many people actually have their pensions in South Africa, in the region. And in terms of international trends, again, it's very hard to compare because some countries have a very advanced social security system, where the state, you contribute towards the state or the state supports some sort of pension fund. And also people may be in theory financially smarter or more educated. I don't think that's the case, but that's what they presume. So some countries like Australia wouldn't force you to annuitize, okay? But now they're beginning to talk of should we annuitize. On the other hand, in the UK, 2 years ago, the Chancellor Osborne shocked the market and suddenly said no more annuities. And that they said, you know, the silver-haired vote is very significant in the UK. And of course, there were also concerns, are people going to go out and buy a Lamborghini now overnight or, you know, all kinds of issues. But that took effect then, I think, on 1st April this year. So you're seeing two countries, probably similar levels of development, doing the opposite things. Ultimately, I think this is a decision for us in our own country. Is there a culture of saving? How vulnerable are people? And that's why you want to have the concept of an income when you retire. But with the lump sum. So it's not an either or. It's a bit of this, but a lot more of monthly income. Is there anything else to... Okay. So that just briefly goes through it. We didn't present slides on it yet. But this is just a written version of compliance.
According to this, we just look at ours there. Although it's a bit more clear, it is clearer and more comprehensive. Members have got any questions about meeting the requirements of 85 and 11.3? No. Okay, that said, can I suggest that, having said everything, we each political party think about things, looks at the emails that have come, and then we come back this afternoon and meet at G26 to decide our respective party positions, right? And it's now 5:00 PM. What I suggest is we move into the financial sector regulation goes till 12, so parties can have from 12 to 1 to look at all the issues, and then at 2:00 see if they can arrive at a position. I know the ANC has a study group this evening. I have been engaging right now, sending an email to the Chief Whip's office and the program. What we have suggested is that we probably won't vote on the bill today. We need discussions with our party political principles and so on. So at earliest we will vote on the bill tomorrow. And it seems there's some discussion between I've been involved in several exchanges yesterday and this morning and right now by email. There is some discussion between the NCOB and the NA for a variety of reasons, not least the strike that's taking place. That Parliament's term for this quarter be extended by a week. This may apply only to the NDOP, because the NA has converted next week's committee week into possibly part plenary and part committee. So I don't think the effect won't affect the NA. I think we will rise next Friday. The NDOP will have to spend an extra week here. So the parties are discussing all this at the moment. So it may well be that we don't have to rush to vote tomorrow morning either. So let us see what's happening at the level of the Woods across the political party. I think the program committee meets on a Wednesday morning, is that right, the Woods Forum, to discuss programs. So we will, by 2:00 tomorrow, I will get a better idea. So in summary, I think it's not probable that we'll vote on the bill today. Depending on whether the NCOP has an extension of a week of its term, we may be able to also postpone the voting tomorrow until we arrive at some consensus on this, or greater consensus on the proposals on time and reform. I see Al's hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two things. Let me deal with the one you've just been in. So we're talking about the committee voting. So if we don't vote on it today, we vote on it tomorrow morning, is it still going to plenary tomorrow afternoon?
No.
No.
So we vote to plenary on Friday. And a good question, and or what I have proposed is Parliament considers, actually, but I don't know whether they'll agree. You see, if you have questions to the House,
I have discovered that you actually cannot put anything else on the agenda. What I have proposed to the powers that be on our side is engage with the other parties. Nothing stops Parliament from ringing the bells at the end of the question time, adjourning for 5 minutes and reconvening. So then we will have the tackles and the MTBPS debated on Thursday. Thursday late afternoon is a possibility. Right. So basically, all of those things are being negotiated. So it's not possible for us now to come to any conclusions. The reason I'm addressing this in the form I am is because people who are outside the committee system, they have a right, especially those who have some or other vested interest in this issue, to know when Parliament is going to vote on a bill, and they have a right to know what outcome is immediately. Now, the problem we have, I'm addressing many of the people outside the committee system and the department here, is that we don't have staff. You know, one of our secretaries is full time on strike. The other is on strike, but seems to be available through internet, you know. So I don't know, I can't describe to people how they strike. So because we don't have, I'm alerting the members who are not inside the system, as it were, because we don't have the staff, we may not be able to notify you, so I don't know how you can keep in touch with maybe Dumasani, or Cindy is a better option because she serves the executive. So yeah, can you help us out here? So maybe if you're worried about when we're going to vote, you keep in touch with Cindy. Okay, having said that, let's move on to the Twin Peaks poll.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, just to answer two things.
The other thing is the bill, as it's been ATC'd, includes amendments which we now are not going to be part of. I mean, but we're not going to withdraw this whole other stuff. Is that, am I right? And the committee has to do that.
No, there's no decision taken on withdrawing anything at this point.
Okay, let's assume that you do it.
Yeah, okay, right.
And so that would then happen at the point in time that we vote on in the, as a committee on it. And so then, will we then receive a final version of the bill without, in other words, an amended version of the bill in time for the plenary?
Yeah, that's all being discussed. You're welcome to come to any meeting. I don't have meetings. You can listen to the telephone conversation if you want to. Nothing secretive about it. Your whip will know tomorrow morning, your programming whip, whoever it is, because our programming whip will go to the proposals. We will feed you those proposals, but so will other people on our side, the majority party side. I don't know whether the majority party will agree with the proposals that I've said to you we've put on our behalf. I have been conferring with the whip on our committee on this matter. But, you know, you'll know tomorrow. But if anybody wants to tag along with me when I go to the toilet and so on, you're welcome to do so. Because I've called and I'm sitting in the toilet. Well, I mean, there's no time now. You can sit outside the cubicle and listen to what I'm saying. I'll put it on voice mail for you. Right? So, you know, anybody wants to come with me everywhere for the next 48 hours? Okay. You come to my house as well. And then, you know, I'm not going to... If you're ANC, you can cheer the stuff I cook. If you're not ANC, well, you bring your own supper. There's nothing secretive. Actually, let me tell you something. It's a chore to be a chair of the committee at this time. Most of my stuff is boring. Frankly, I ring people, don't answer, I ring a bank, I ask somebody for their full names and their ID numbers. It takes them 40, I don't know if anybody can, it takes them like 72 hours to give you their names and their ID numbers. Right. So, I mean, this is what I do. Most of my life is administrative. I've never been in a situation before. Right. No, I'm not talking, I am actually amused and bemused that, you know, I could be productive. But I do most of my stuff at the moment is administrative. I mean, paid. Right. So, fine. Okay, don't needle me. Okay, over to you, Momo and your team. You'll fire Roy because I told him repeatedly we're going to start by 11. And I'm very good. It's 11:15. He's not here. Well, if you can sort him out, can we move on to the phone? Oh, before we do, there is a response from Bridget Five, and can you take us through it? So the last issue. On proposals from the research side, on the written submissions made, what research units get. I think they confirmed it to you. So on each of these issues, just give us, don't summarize what they said because we know. Just what is our response?
Yes, It's more the summary of what they think.
No, if it's a summary, then we've covered that. Is there anything in guidance the PBO or the research unit is giving us on your views on what our response should be?
Well, Okay, I think that is on the third
issue. Okay, just about the overview. No, I think it's on the response on the report I sent you this morning. But I think we wanted to check that first before you send it.
All right, fine.
But now, what I have, remember, Chair, there were other conditions that were not presented.
Yeah.
So I think that's why I thought that was better. Essentially, it's not something different from what Mr. Sergio has already responded to. But of course, as I said, you need to be had. There were five additional public submissions from N to Carrefour. And Payroll Offers Group of South Africa, Boosfa, and Towers Watson. That's the end site, South African Student Export Channels. And I think most of the issues that they just want to touch on issues, the submission there. I think N to Carrefour raised an issue on the was just responding to neglecting or leaving the GPF away from the amendment, the concern that could expose government to constitutional challenges in that regard, and from the issues that came up with the network that are not addressed, and to Crawford think that can expose government to constitutional challenges in that regard. But I think, they support the amendment, the proposed amendment, but of course they're saying there's the issue of the trying to link the tariff to inflation, trying to increase, not giving it, not keeping it there, trying to say, can that be increased annually? I think that's what also Busa is saying. So can that tariff to be relooked at? And in some saying, it's quite good that you put in proposals ahead. I think they've changed it just to 50. And the GPF, social issues are coming out there. Thanks.
Okay, Brandon?
Just a question, Mr. Chair. I read Andrew Crawford's submission quickly. Who does he represent? Is he a sole person or is he part of
us? I'll send you email in that regard. We've covered that issue. Basically, if I understand you correctly, that's not a Busa position, is that right?
Yes,
it's
a
Busa position. Busa.
I represent ASISA, which is one of the major members of USA. USA operates on mandated basis, and the views of Andrew Corbett, as he has expressed them in these recent exchanges, are not the views of USA or of ASISA. In some of the various exchanges, but there have been very many of them, he has made it clear that these are his personal views.
I think that's the issue that I found here as well, because the presentation are separate from Busa. Andrew Crawford made own presentation separately from Busa as well, because Busa is Andrew Crawford submission. Thanks.
Okay.
Just estimating the whippery of our bosses, as it were, on our side about proposals of program as I've stated out to you. So I'm not being rude. Okay. But that's it. Can we move on now to the financial sector regulation bill?
So I let the committee, we stopped at, I think, Prudential Authority, right? So can you quickly go through the slide and then...
So we have page 30, chapter 3, and then the slide. Could you get us quickly to the slide and then the pause?
Okay, I was hoping that the staff would be here. They are on their way. I think that there were problems with flights and so on, as I explained. If you don't mind, can we start with chapter 4? I know that the staff will be here, but it's also a kind of better option, I think, to look at chapter 4, because it kind of deals purely with the regulator. There's no sort of other issues that are part of the SAR, and you also deal with monetary policy and so on. So you sort of see what one of the tools are supposed to be like, and you find the other twin is not quite the same as this twin, because there's 8 different houses, okay? So if we look at both 56, and who's got the slide? I'm sorry.
The text is slide to give the context, but it's an easier level.
So if we get to 4, the famous triangle diagram that Roy presented. So basically this authority will have, it's called the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. Bear in mind, a conduct authority deals with how a financial institution conducts its business, and also deals with how you protect customers and so on of that financial institution. So the way it's designed is that there's a commissioner and 2 to 4 deputy commissioners. And the model that we have is that, as I said last week, that there's no board, okay? That's part-time. What you want is the set of commissioners to effectively be a full-time set of commissioners who would collectively make decisions on everything. So obviously they will delegate further down, and if you look at the diagram below, you'll find, you know, there'll be departments. We are definitely moving away from
for members, but there's no numbering of these things. I don't know why, but it's chapter 4, key characteristics of the
page.
There's no page, so
16 at the bottom. I see here.
Page
chapter 4. This
key characteristics FSEA.
Yeah.
Financial Sector Conduct Authority.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you look at it below the leadership, and you have, you obviously have departments, and they'll decide how to structure their departments. But we're moving decisively away, not just from the board approach in the FSB, but also sort of we feel that there are silos both within the regulator and between regulators. And what would happen currently in the FSB, of course, would be that each of those rings below, they would be the deputy registrar for pensions, deputy registrar for collective investment schemes, and they would decide. And let me just show you one difficulty with that. If you look at the retirement area, yes, there's a deputy registrar for, or DO for retirement funds, okay. But part of the retirement funds, a vital component, are annuities, okay. And annuities fall within the insurance. And of course, when we look at this, we say, how much coordination is there between the two regulators? If you really want a seamless approach to retirement. That's why we feel quite strongly that you want one place where they take everything into account and not just in part of the chain. So they would have their structure. So if you look at the... Now, once you have a commission, you want to make sure that the normal features of a board are not compromised. So they need to have an audit committee, a remuneration committee. So you'll have these committees. And we've said that, and you know, we're not fussed about where they get appointed, but generally we've just said, look, the Director General of the Treasury will appoint these subcommittees, which will then obviously report to the commissioners and so on remuneration, risk, and audit. So in terms of clauses then, if you look at clause 56, okay, it establishes the conduct authority as a juristic person. And like all entities, it's subject to the PFMA. Okay. So this is a pure model, it's under the PFMA. When we're going to get to the prudential authority, because it's within SAB, and because the SAB is not has its own act and is not covered by the PFMA, it's one of the few exclusions, and for good reason, because you want the Reserve Bank to operate with real agility. So that would be one clause. Then you look at clause 57, which sort of sets up the objective, and though we're not dealing with it, I just want you to see the similarity, that when you get to clause 32, which is for the prudential authority, there it's just established, we can say that the PA is a juristic person within the South, but obviously, as I said, it's not a public entity in terms of the PFMA, because it's part of the South. But look at the objective in 33, and it will be useful at some point when members compare, because the one will deal with the safety and soundness, the prudential side of financial institutions, whereas if you look at clause 57, the objective of the FSCA is to enhance and support the efficiency and integrity of the financial system, but to protect financial customers by on the one hand, and that doesn't just cover the fair treatment, but it covers things like financial education, providing literacy, and so on. And like everyone, you've got to assist in financial stability. So if you just compare to clause 33, so in 33A, that's a purely prudential function, as is B. Now, there's an element of protecting customers or even within the prudential authority. So if you look at the banking supervisor, they are charged with ensuring that the deposits of retail investors are safe, okay? That prudential by definition means that the financial institution can meet whatever promise is made to the customer. That if the promise is thou can withdraw your funds at any time, then of course they need to ensure that's the case. Of course, in the case of a bank, if 100% decide to withdraw their deposits at the same time, then you have a problem. So there's and we'll deal with those in a separate discussion. But you'll notice they also have to assist in maintaining financial stability. So compare objective 57, and they've also got to assist in maintaining financial stability. And A is a more general, as I said, efficiency and integrity of the system, so that's your market conduct. And B is a more specific, treating customers fairly. But they both have the objective of assisting in maintaining financial stability. Okay. Then we deal more specifically with the...
on process, when we're going through a particular clause, right, if members got any questions to ask, just ask it. So just interrupt. There's no need to turn up at all, because I'm reading what's saying wrong. But can I raise something? Now, Frank, I've lost out sometimes, but I just want to raise this thing again. You see, we ask them to draft in simple English. I must tell you, I read past them, because I had some time. And now yesterday, I'm not covering it again for those of you who missed it. I could write a book on yesterday. I was totally unproductive 16 hours later, and I never read this book from beginning to end as I planned to. But I did read the thing. You see, in real life, people don't have objectives. They don't have objectives, right? Because you've got objectives and you've got 3, A, B, C, D. So that is the objective. Now, you will tell me in legalese it means aims. It's plural, and the word is a singular word, right? In the Municipal Systems Act, we won that battle. Objectives, there are four of them, right? But now, back to square one. You see, we go around circles in Parliament, right? Personally, I think it should be objective. I won't dive in the bit about it, but I'm just alerting you to this, right, when we actually look at the clauses. Then, on the issue of the functions, right? I wanted to ask you, right, you covered this in a way. There's substantial overlap in parts with the prudential authority, I see. Now, what you mean by F? Regularly review the perimeter. I've never seen this word before in this context. Perimeter and scope. What does perimeter mean? But, all right, fine. Can you come back to these things?
Yeah, we'll come back to
these. Can I just alert you? I don't want a discussion, because members have got a chance to read this book over Christmas and whatever,
yeah,
right? But just signal this. We don't waste time, right? Right. Somebody can note this thing and send us an email. perimeter. Okay, what does that mean, right? Then the issue I wanted to ask is, we keep saying the regulator supervisor. Remind me, it's like when I look at this thing, right? Remember I started now reading from chapter where we ended. So I did the earlier part. But can I ask you something? There's a general question that arises. It was raised by Tandi actually on Friday. Obviously, institutions have to be, to some other degree, independent. But when they regulate, is there like a framework or paradigm within which they regulate so that while they're independent, they're not outside of some sort of broad ministerial supervision?
Yes, Chairman.
What does regulate mean here? You know, they can just regulate what they want, or do they do it within some paradigm or framework?
No, it's within a paradigm.
Right, so you... Don't respond to my niggling thing about objective and objective.
I'll leave that later when we finally come right to the end. We can argue about whether you can ask or not. But I think on the obviously the substance, and I think this is really important for members and for all of us, is what is the difference between regulation or your power to regulate and supervision? These are different things. Supervision is, I guess, like someone who supervises, like an inspector. You go in, you check that they're doing the right thing. And I've almost wondered whether we shouldn't call this a financial sector. Well, we have a debate. We call them a regulatory authority or a supervisory authority, and then we just left them both out. Okay? Because they do have the power to regulate. Is almost like a legislative power. It's where you can direct or you can have subordinate legislation in effect. You can say all banks must do ABC. Okay? But what we've done is then say that there's a regulator with a big R, which is effectively the minister. Okay? So big things, like in future, if there's not that I think the law will necessarily, I'm in danger of maybe contradicting what we say here, but we would want a big decisions, like the decision to have, say, Basel III, should be a bigger decision, and that should be through main legislation or regulation. But the gory detail, how you define capital, currently it comes to the minister, and none of us like to just rubber stamp. So we want the regulator to be able to decide on what the exact definition is, especially if there's not big economic consequences. Then they need to come to us from the policy perspective, to the minister. But in the way they regulate, they need to not just regulate so that when you know that there's a problem with the definition, you want to know, in a sense, whose ass to kick, okay? So, yes, okay. It's very important. When we were doing the PFMA, the big issue was two. Don't try and divide responsibility. When you say two people are responsible, I strongly believe nobody is responsible, okay? So even if something's done jointly, you want to say, within the joint, you do that and you do the other. So when they do this regulation, they'll be fully responsible. Later on in the bill, we say what they can regulate, and Roy can just point out the tools. But it's also important to see how they regulate. So what process do they follow? Because I can tell you that many regulators that have absolutely no intention to really consult properly. And I think that's often depends on the individual. Everybody says, no, I consult, but I don't agree with anything that you said. Okay? And that's a consistent approach. You can't have that kind of regulator as well. So watching the process, whether they take comments from the regulator, how they take comments, and if there's a problem, you need to deal with those sorts of issues. But do you want to just talk about the regulator and the supervisor?
Yeah, let me just respond again.
What we're picking up, Latanya, I think, is a theme, right? It's the relationship between the government and these agencies, right? What is the latitude of regulation? And the paradigm or framework in which they do it. Some parties may argue for greater autonomy, and others may argue for lesser autonomy, and so on. But very quickly, just let us, Roger, where it is, and tell me what to do the question.
Thanks, Jay. As I look at it, since chapter 7, where we discuss in detail what exactly the authority and make, if you like, regulatory functions at the moment, highlighted the importance of regulators are accepting the rules and supervision is just making sure that the rules are appropriately implemented. And in chapter 7 we talk about the very narrow scope of which the fuel authorities may make standards for these instruments that they make, for these standards.
Alright, so basically,
when we come to that, we'll get a clear understanding, right? Okay. And the next quick thing I want to ask you is,
actually, I want to emphasize what I was asking. I was not yet at a situation where I want to make a distinction between the role of government and the role of the regulatory framework.
Not at all, right?
Yeah, I'm saying I'm not yet arrived at that. The question here is, it's more about defining in clear terms what do you mean by regulating. Because you see here it's an authority, it's a competent authority anyway. In an ideal environment you would not want to take more powers from it. But you also plan for unintended consequences. So you may say that there's too much powers. How then do you have a consistent monitoring over the very same boat of authority? So that the definition doesn't limit either the regulatory body or government intervention in this instance. So it's an issue to flag so that the definition of that must not lead to an unintended consequence. Because I think for technical reasons you not want them to consult all the time, but you know, so how do you define? Because it's a very normative statement if it's not legally explained. I know in legislation it's not possible to explain everything in terms of how you wait. I don't know, Frank might want to advise us on that one. But maybe there will be some guidelines somewhere that explains what we mean by that. So that tomorrow they don't consult the minister or let's say, but I'm regulating. I have that right. Because sometimes there's a human element in what people do for reasons that we might not foresee in the current context.
Yeah.
So it's what I try to emphasize the point is without belaboring it.
And that's really very important to figure out what are the powers of the minister as the sort of as government. What's the power of the supervisory agency? And we'll get to later on. And we talked on Friday about operational independence. And I think, for example, just to give an obvious case, when a regulator or supervisor acts and there's fiscal consequences on financial stability, as we saw it, the governor, for example, has to consult with the Minister of Finance. So similarly, a lot of this is premised on broader consultation, okay? And I think we should come to that because once you go to the bill, I think it will be useful then to say, now you've seen all the powers. This is the role of the minister, and you might have a slide on that. This is the role of the supervisors, okay? And there's a lot of gray areas between. So how do you deal with that? So let's come back to that. But what I wanted to show members, so if you look at clause 58, and I still want to just say, because there's two in this here, that you just look at clause 34 as well, okay? So you see that there's some things that are quite similar.
They're overlapping, eh?
Yeah, okay. So for example, if you take B, the issue of you know, A is a bit more specific to them, but generally it's to regulate and supervise in accordance with financial sector law, to say that for both. Although we have to spell out a bit more for the prudential regulator because we include market infrastructure and there's a definition that we did alert you to, but perhaps you need to talk a bit more about what is market infrastructure so that Roy answered that hard question. But if you just go through 58, you'll see B is almost identical, if not identical, I haven't checked every word. You'll see that C also has the Council for Medical Schemes, okay? You'll see D, you know, is different from, the two E's are different, but the Competitions Commission comes in both. There's slight differences. You'll see that both have to promote financial inclusion. And then the perimeter story is a common F, and G, well, is there as H, but you'll see that for 58, and I know Roy was working on a bill, and I was saying to him, let's rather do a policy paper. The key issue here is, how do you pay for all of this? So the financial sector conduct authority will be the one that's doing the collection, broadly, right? So that's the idea that we have. It's an area that we're still sort of developing, but they would then give to the South that portion. You don't want everybody collecting. And the question is, what do they collect, how much, etc. At the moment, we've just sort of kept to what is the status quo. The FSB actually does levy a fee for different types of activities, and that's how it funds itself.
Could you have some examples of that levy?
So there would be a levy on if you an insurance company, okay, and like a bank, but same with companies. So let me move away from insurance. Jonathan Dixon's going to come here, and we don't deal with these ourselves. But let's take pension funds, okay, that for every pension fund that gets registered or the administrator, they have to provide a fee. Do you want to provide more details? Because I'm not too familiar with the exact formula.
Yeah, they want to say every single institution is levied a fee based on particular different bases from industry to industry. So in the case of pension funds, which the number of members in the pension fund, and I think the fee is 40 rand. For a pension fund member, and in the case of insurance...
Is that for a year?
For a year, yeah. And in the case of insurance, that 0.04% of the value of the liability. It basically just gives the FSB enough money to supervise the cost.
Now, with this proposal you've got, will that levy be substantially increased?
Our current projections are that we probably will not have to increase it substantially. But the FSB won't. Although we had a very good meeting yesterday with the CFP on their plans in terms of the size of the organisation. But I think during the hearing, we just have plans to give you a bit of a presentation in terms of how big the new organisation will be, the new structure, and probably how much it will cost.
But I guess, Chair, the answer would be yes and no, okay? We don't want them to start with a big levy and they don't know how to spend it, okay? The capacity of the regulator will develop. The point is that compared to where we are currently, the scope of the regulators has been increasing significantly. So if you increase it, yes, it will mean that you will pay more to be regulated. But it's going to depend on what you've been charged for. So if you are a SIFI, the charges are going to be much higher. And currently in our system, what you also have is that with banks, because the SARB holds their capital and doesn't pay interest, okay, it uses that to fund its supervisory activities. Okay.
Not only fund, I just need clarity on what we are doing. We are, it's like a sort of workshop type thing we agreed on, right? We have to know what this bill is about. Some of us are going out on a study tour. We need to know exactly what's in this bill, see what's happening elsewhere, and compare and ask the questions around, this is what we're doing in our bill. How can you go out which you do not care about the bill? So, unfortunately, it's a painstakingly slow process. I don't know how the committee operated before, but all I know, Frank, is this is the way it's supposed to be done. Supposed to understand every clause, right? Not just be on policy and then say, clause 8 to 14, any questions? No, that will come at the end, right, Frank? Am I doing anything wrong? Right, fine. That's all I know. Right. So we will sit here. That's why I said, forget your bill for when you wanted it. You wanted it in the 5th of January. No. It's going to be on 5th of January 2020. Fine. If there has to be. But we're not passing this bill until we understand everything. Not under my watch, anyway. If I'm on, we never know politics.
Right? I haven't checked myself out right now. Who knows? I mean, I don't know. I'll be told, hey, Harry, you're doing such a good job. Right? We want you to go to Mongolia. Yeah, okay? You see, in the ANC, nobody gets demoted, right? Right? If nobody gets demoted in the ANC, as I keep saying, everybody's promoted. So they'll take you out from being chair and tell you, hey, come on, you're doing such a good job in finance. We want to move you, come on, you did so good. Go to Mongolia and be our ambassador there. And if I ask, what are our trade links to the ambassador? They say, no, that's why we send you, because you just have this trade link. So all I know is what I'm doing, Frank. You tell me whether I'm doing anything wrong. Right. So, like, Frank, you chair me. And you say, Jefferson, the question you're asking is out of order, right? So you can chair me. You're the lawyer, right? So basically, Tandy, the thing is, we have to know what his levies are. I didn't know. What exactly are these levies, right? And are you going to increase these levies? Because tomorrow, they're going to come here next week, right? They're going to say, oh, this bill is going to have huge financial implications for us. No. That week, Mr. Momoniat and Mr. Roy, let's use Roy, right? Because Momoniat will tell me everything of Roy. Mr. Roy said, you know, half a month in, whatever. Yeah, okay.
Over to you.
I jump on a few of them on this one, because there's quite a team working on this chair. So, just to get through, so, and that's why on the issue of levy, we do have to get the money bill, we'll come to you separately. But what we want to put out is a paper as you consider the bill, so you see exactly what we're talking about. And obviously we have to start at the point where we now, and what's been charged, okay. But as you get towards the risk-based approach, it's going to certainly increase the regulatory fees will increase. And let me say, if you are going to the UK, you'll see just how these things have increased significantly.
I'm thinking of themes here.
Dimas Man is asking me. There are like several themes emerging, right? What you will try to do by next week, before the hearings if possible, and after, is to organize the themes.
And Chair, I think the last time we were asked also on the scope of savings, because you do want to have some rationalization. That's an issue that could be looked at some point as well. But if you get to 58 then, so you'll see that in this case, the specific issues, of course, then relate to, as I said, G, but certainly I and J. So, you know, I deals with fair outcomes for customers, and J deals with financial education strategies. I would just like to say to members, just try and compare between the two. Sometimes you see the specific because one is prudential, the other is market conduct, so that differs. But these have to be conjoined twins, okay? You can't have them acting independently of each other, and that's another issue for independence. You can't say both are independent, and if both impact on someone, there needs to be regulatory coordination and cooperation between the two. Otherwise, what the one will do, the other can undo, and it would be a disaster. So you really need to understand the independence in that broader context. Then if you look at the clauses, and I don't know if Roy wants to expand on those functions, but and he can do so in a second. But then you look at 2, 3, 4, we've obviously had to deal with the fact that there is a credit regulator who does credit agreements, okay? So we have to factor that. But do you want to just talk through the rest? Effie also deals with it, but she's probably still on her way.
Clause 2 of 3, 4, just obviously the same things. There is a similar clause 3 regarding hiring the performance functions and further in terms of other provisions of legislation. And then 4 just talks to the need for the law to provide for the authorities to work closely with their other counterparts in other jurisdictions. There are important requirements later on for memorandum understanding so that they will have agreements between themselves and similar authorities elsewhere. So, for example, let's take example ADFA that is here in South Africa, but large transfer of business obviously is a subsidiary of the bank in London. So they need a lot of, they have huge numbers of memorandum understanding between the two authorities in terms of how to supervise markets in South Africa and in London. and they have 20 town visits, and they have this whole process going on, so they're definitely correct about that. And then clause 5 for the conduct authority, clause again, to need to take into account the National Credit Act and the REACH requirements underneath that act. And then there's a talk about a primarily preemptive outcome focused and risk-based approach. And that really means what the second part of the sentence talks about, which is prioritizing the use of those resources according to risks. So sometimes you find a regulator that's just doing it everybody. And then when we do the insurance bill, we'll explain how we'd like to differentiate between big insurance companies and what we call micro-insurance companies. Because it's not fair, I think, for a very small insurance company like a funeral partner to have the same capital requirements as a huge insurance company. That's a huge part of the insurance bill. And this sentence sort of talks to that. And then obviously in C, then have regards to international regulatory standards and taking into account circumstances in South Africa. And you have similar wording in 34 sub 4.
When it's not only also the issue of how you adhere to the regulations and the rules, not basically all the rules of it. Especially for a small industry. Is there any provision that you can get that?
Yeah, very quickly. How it probably work out is that for smaller institutions, the bank authority won't really worry about that. But the conduct authority will be more interested. So definitely in the case of like funeral parlors, which we call micro insurers, the real issue is how do they sell the products to customers. And if they fail, there's no risk. So there will probably be substantially more role for the conduct of products.
What happens is, because it's a risk-based approach, Prudential Authority will, you know, we also want Prudential Authority, although we have a pure model, to worry about everyone so much that they ignore the big risks. So they may spend zero time, and we'll see later in the Act, they will delegate all the prudential things probably to the conduct authority, I would expect. Okay?
Okay, let me get on
to the
point, and that's what I'll get to. So when you get to, sorry Roy, if you look at point 6 there, they must act with the must perform their functions without fear, favor, or prejudice, and we say the same thing about the PA, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But they must do that within the framework of cooperating. The PA still falls under the governor, okay? So I'm just saying there are all those issues to take into account. What do we mean by the independence? How independent are they? It should be within a framework. It should be within coordination. Because as we said, and we had a real-life experience in South Africa, the one regulator acted, and we said, surely what you do can't sink the entire system in the country, okay? So you do need to take stability into account, and it needs to moderate how you act.
Would it be covered in the guidelines, or
would it be too much? No, we've got coordination. I think we should have guidelines, but then you will have like we've got the Financial Stability Oversight Committee, and there's a chapter that deals with coordination and cooperation, which is what, 5 or?
Yeah.
Okay, which is quite a critical chapter to look at, and it doesn't just apply to these students, but all the others in the classroom who also act.
Can we not check?
Yeah.
We're done with 58. Are there any questions, comments on 58 as a whole and specific clauses banded? And we have to tie up in about 5 minutes because it's 12 o'clock and we agreed we'll reconvene at 2. Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, some point out, there's a whole new version of this. I just realized that we've got the same number, but the content is different. So this bill that we got, the original, is different from the one that's in the file.
Yeah.
Is.
So the one that's in the file, the one we use.
Yes,
the
same.
You have to look at his B34.
Yes. Doesn't that both have B34?
All right, give me several of that matter outside this meeting. Can you look at it since... Yeah, we must all work on one bill, and we're on page 39. Brandon, are you on page 39, clause 58? Okay. So that's been something wrong.
But you
all
should
right.
look at the naval bill. That's what we want you to look at. Okay, so we'll check with that small... any.
So on clause 58, any other comments? Can I have a few quick things, right? When you say outcomes-based, what do you mean? Very quickly. The question that arises here is also, you're referring repeatedly, I see, elsewhere in the book, to the National Credit Act and the NCR, right? So one of the themes that arises, as was raised on Friday, is, you know, where should the NCR belong? Okay? Has there been any discussion in cabinet and, or, well, I mean, not cabinet, but I mean, in the government processing of this bill amongst officials? About where the NCR should exist, where the NCR should be located, or even should the NCR exist at all in the new system. So that's the second set of questions, right? Thirdly, under 5A, Roy, we mean regulate requirements for financial institutions that are authorized and regulated. Well, what do you mean by financial institutions in this context? I'm not clear. Okay, those are three questions, right?
Sorry? I'm asking about
58.5A after the word and.
Right. Quickly, Roy, please, we're running out of time.
Outcome-based approach here, obviously, to achieve the objectives of the authority. So,
what do you mean the outcomes in
respect of your objective set out in 57? Oh, that's what you mean. Okay, fine. Okay, good. Thank you.
I will answer the second NCA question. So the financial institutions that are authorized, those are what we call national credit, those are what we call credit providers. So the University of Lewis is still signed and saying credit providers.
Oh, right. All credit providers.
Yeah.
And the like.
All credit providers are usually all the financial service providers.
Right.
Which means they also have a license from the SEC under the Financial Advice Engineering Service Act. So most places have two licenses.
So like you go to the...
Because right, they ask me, do you want to just clear the card?
Yeah.
I don't take these things, but I mean, that's like what you're talking about. Good. Okay. Clear.
Yeah.
Next.
And then your question here on... Look, you know, we've got to try to focus on rationalization and so on. I think that it's a question of... We also don't want to eat the elephant whole, okay? Even though I don't eat meat, okay, but anyway. But the point is that on a regulatory side, there's a lot of transition risk. So, and it doesn't just apply to the NCR. As I said, there's a mortgage, what's it? Okay. You know, you find there's actually a plethora of issues. I think that at some point when you look at costs, rationalization, what's been done, because this regulator will actually cover could in theory cover others, and as we also said, you know, the National Credit Act is the important issue, and that there is a regulator, and how they coordinate is really the big point which you need to deal with. And if you look at the UK too, this thing was done in steps. Okay, they didn't. In fact, they had a separate credit regulator, and they had a separate. Currently, pensions regulator. So you know, we've not tried to start there, because then I think you start possibly getting into turf fights and so on. I think the proof of the pudding is in the system, just like with the Council for Medical Schemes. Okay, if you have NHI, maybe there's no need for medical schemes, but to the extent that you have medical schemes, it's a financial product, and you know, even if we. Like this bill doesn't try to do get involved with medical schemes, because it's a very deep hole to get involved in. It's very complex. But I'm raising this. But even they, I would submit, should have a twin peaks approach, because there's a lot of confusion. I think that either regulator, prudential regulator, i.e., to see that your medical scheme will actually pay when there's a claim, or do they check
who checks for market conduct that your medical scheme actually pays? So you can afford it, but you just decide that, no, this wasn't covered in the fine print, okay? And I can tell you, even officials who work or people who work in that company won't know really when something happens to them whether their medical aid will pay or not. So the market conduct, consumer protection, or customer protection are all important issues. So I think the tools that you have here from TUDIS can be applied to a lot of the regulators. If at a later stage, you know, there's a discourse about can we improve things, can we do things better than the current arrangements, so be it, but we didn't want to start there.
Another thing, yes, Vivian? Comrade Vivian? Comrade Vivian? Comrade Sharon?
It's fine.
Actually, it
was my call. I would have preferred all these regulatory bodies to belong to one organization. If it was my call,
they're not a regulatory council, right?
Because you have the Competition Commission there, you have this there, and so on. I used to find it very interesting that Public Works is responsible for property of government. When you know, I couldn't make sense of that. I would have wished it was all government property could have belonged somewhere, but it's not for me to decide. Maybe we should look deeper into this matter and look at how other countries are handling it, so that we make a recommendation.
Are you suggesting
you
visit all
the fucking... No, there's also the research. You are dragging me to the UK, that's what you're not telling people. You're not telling people that you are dragging me to the UK. I can't use the excuse that I don't have a passport and... You know why I'm saying this, Chair? In the current conjunction, the work time plan of government is very interesting. How we structure government departments and so on. So maybe it's one issue that will help to deal with a broader challenge. And I'm saying this was, and I'm going to make a simple example, and I hope nobody will take political advantage of that. I think we fight.
It's very business. Alright.
You have. A principle of wanting to build industrial, like industrialists in the GTI, but your bigger funding is IDC and is in the Economic Development Department. So, at what point do you synergize this to be one thing? So, I don't want to get deep into the debate, but this can actually try to untangle such challenges by putting all these institutions in or have effective coordination. I don't know how, but we can make a recommendation in the legislation.
No.
Chair, if you allow. Yeah. I'm not suggesting anything for now. I'm saying it's an issue we can look at.
Here's another theme. We've identified rationalization. We have to hear what the National Credit Regulator is afraid of. My peripheral. Very superficial reading of this bill. They are included anyway, I can see it. I mean, you know, they feel very nervous and anxious. Yeah. So we need to look at it. They come to make representations next week or whatever the public hearings are. Can I say they're now drawn to halt? It's part 2 at 2 o'clock. The study group of the ANC is meeting here. And everybody else, exit, please. Can you? The
ANC comes first. Go.
Just to be clear, at 2 o'clock, do we agree? It's G26.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, please, don't come here at G26, okay? I haven't got the time to answer with all of you. Right, G26, 2 o'clock, then you go and vote. Don't tell your wish you couldn't vote because you're exempted, right? Go and vote when the bell rings.
Certainly, I'll be exempted.
You can go and mark yourself present if you want. The first 5 minutes, that's fine. Why don't we do that, right? So why don't we convene at 2:15? People go and mark themselves present, and we convene at 2:15. Then are you listening? I think maybe people should go and press the button, come on to the thing there, and we come at 2:15, right?
So 2:15
is G20.
What time do we end?
Well, as soon as we can.
Okay.
We want to finish the bill as much as we can, because
okay.
We now we have a loose hand.
But roughly you're talking 5, 6, 8 o'clock at night?
No. We'll finish with the house rises.
Okay.
We have to finish with the house rises because the study group.
Okay.
What kind of house rises? Is there anybody know today? Yeah. Alright. Can you please go now? And they're going to adopt our money. Also, they're going to
Can you bring them to M515? Okay, thanks.